Okay, let's unpack this. We're diving deep into the world of one of Canada's, well, financial titans, the Royal Bank of Canada, RBC. You sent us a real treasure trove of insights here, investment analyses, detailed earnings reports, a whole lot. And our mission today, it's pretty clear. Distill it all down for you, give you the crucial nuggets, cut through the noise, you know, just informed, but well-informed.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here, I think, is that we're not just looking at, another bank, not at all. We're really examining a complex, pretty diversified financial ecosystem. It's one that seems to have really mastered navigating these dynamic global and local landscapes. So this deep dive, it should help us understand not just what RBC is as an institution, but how it strategically positions itself and, crucially, why those strategies matter. And that matters not only for its millions of clients, but honestly for the entire Canadian economy.
Absolutely. So whether you're maybe a current investor trying to understand your holdings, or perhaps a prospective investor sizing up a new opportunity, maybe a business owner dealing with their services, or maybe you're just, intensely curious about the forces shaping Canada's financial heartbeat, this deep dive should equip you with that shortcut. We'll explore its enduring strengths, those big strategic moves like the recent HSBC acquisition, and of course, the challenges it faces as it keeps adapting. Okay, so let's start by laying the cornerstone, the foundation of this financial giant. 1.1 Company Overview, a century and a half of financial leadership.
Indeed, let's do that. We're talking about an institution that stood as Canada's largest financial institution by market cap for, well, a considerable time, and it maintains that position with, frankly, remarkable consistency. Founded way back 1864, RBC boasts a really long-standing history. That's not just about age, right? It's a testament to its proven resilience, its adaptability through countless economic cycles, wars, recessions, booms, you name it. And the sheer scale is just impressive. Over 17 million clients.
17 million. Wow.
Yeah. And not just across Canada and the US, but also in 27 other countries. It really underscores a significant, truly global footprint.
That's incredible reach. So, okay, this isn't really a bank. It's a financial powerhouse, deep historical roots, global presence. But for you listening, what does that truly mean for how it operates? And why is it so remarkably robust? It really seems to boil down to its highly diversified business model that consistently emerges as its core strategic strength. It's a feature we see providing big advantages time and again.
Yeah, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, a diversified model isn't simply about offering, a wide array of services. It's fundamentally about building resilience. That's the key. It ensures the bank generates earnings from multiple business lines. And often these lines aren't correlated. Think of it like a sophisticated multi-stage shock absorber for the bank.
A shock absorber, right. That's a good analogy.
Exactly. So when one part of the economy or maybe the financial market faces significant headwinds, another part might actually be thriving. And that helps smooth out the overall performance across different economic cycles. The fascinating implication here is that this diversification often translates directly into higher investor confidence. And ultimately, that can mean a premium valuation for the bank, even when some segments are feeling the pressure. Investors seem willing to pay a bit more for that kind of stability.
That's a perfect analogy for understanding how it all works together.
Sure.
So let's deconstruct this shock absorber a bit further. Let's look at RBC's five primary business segments. These aren't just departments, are they? They really are distinct pillars of its operation, each playing a critical role in generating those impressive financial results and contributing to that overall resilience. 1.2, the five pillars. Deconstructing RBC's business segments.
Precisely. Okay, starting with personal and commercial banking, PNCB. This is unequivocally the bedrock. It's RBC's largest and arguably most stable segment. It's the engine room, right? Providing everything from everyday deposits and loans to mortgages and investments for individuals and for businesses too, primarily focused on Canada and the Caribbean. Now, in the second quarter of 2024, this segment generated net income of just over $2 billion.
$2 billion, okay.
Yeah, which was a healthy 7% increase year over year. And what makes this growth particularly noteworthy, I think, is that it was driven by higher net interest income from wider spreads and robust volume growth in Canadian banking, including, importantly, the initial contribution, albeit maybe lower margin, from that HSBC Canada acquisition. So this segment is the steady engine, often less volatile. Provides that reliable earning stream that really underpins the entire bank.
Okay, bedrock established. Then we pivot to wealth management. This seems like a truly global growth engine for RBC. This segment caters to, well, affluent, high net worth, and institutional clients, offering a pretty sophisticated suite of services: investment management, wealth planning, private banking. and asset management through RBC Global Asset Management. In Q2 2024, it reported a net income of $769 million, also up a solid 7% from the prior year.
Right. Solid growth there, too.
Yeah, and here's where it gets particularly interesting for long-term growth, I think. Wealth management isn't just about, you know, managing the money people already have. It seems like a dual-pronged growth strategy.
Yeah.
It leverages market appreciation, right? Benefiting from rising asset values.
Mm-hmm.
But it also actively focuses on attracting new clients and their assets, which increases its fee-based client assets. It feels like a dynamic sector, capitalizes on both broad market movements and that strategic client acquisition.
Absolutely. It's about growth on two fronts. Following that, we have capital markets. Now, this is where RBC provides corporate and investment banking, global market services, transaction banking, serving corporations, institutions, governments worldwide. This segment is significant, but it's inherently more volatile. It acts as a crucial kind of opportunistic contributor. And its record performance in Q2 2024 really highlights this. Delivered remarkable net income over $1.2
billion. Wow, $1.2 billion.
Yeah, a substantial 31% increase year over year. And this perfectly illustrates how that diversified model can offset pressures elsewhere. This segment was propelled by strong M&A activity, merger and acquisition activity, alongside robust equity and debt origination. It truly showcases the strength of having those non-correlated business lines, where one sector can really shine, deliver outsized results, even when other parts of the economy might be facing, you know, different conditions.
Right, so capital markets can really punch above its weight sometimes. And then rounding out the revenue-generating segments is insurance. Smaller, you said, but a reliably consistent niche, offering life, health, property, casualty insurance products. Adding another layer of stability to RBC's diverse portfolio, it reported net income of $177 million in Q2 2024, a modest 4% increase from the prior year, primarily driven by a favorable investment-related experience. So maybe not a huge growth driver, but consistent, predictable.
Exactly. That's a steady contributor. And finally, we have corporate support. Now, the segment comprises centralized corporate functions. It's primarily a cost center. It absorbs things like unallocated revenues and expenses, as well as costs related to enterprise-level strategic initiatives. In Q2 2024, this segment reported a net loss of $309 million, which was largely due to absorbing significant transaction and integration costs, specifically related to that HSBC Canada acquisition.
Okay, so that loss isn't necessarily a red flag then.
No, I don't think so. It's important to see this segment's temporary negative impact not as a weakness, but really as a necessary strategic investment for future growth. These are the upfront costs, right? For a major strategic move designed to benefit the entire bank in the long run.
Got it. So when we pull all these segments together, the bank reported total net income of just under $4 billion for Q2 2024, representing overall 7% growth year over year. And the clear story here seems to be RBC's diversified model, particularly its ability to capitalize on those record capital markets earnings. That was the primary driver. It's a powerful testament to that strategic diversification, demonstrating that even with ongoing challenges, a balanced portfolio can deliver consistent growth. 1.3 geographic footprint, core in Canada, growth in the U.S.
Absolutely. That balance is key. Okay, moving on to RBC's geographic footprint. This is critical for understanding its strategic positioning. As of the third quarter of 2024, its revenue distribution, well, it shows a strong reliance on its domestic market, 63% coming from Canada.
63%, that's substantial.
It is. Then the U.S. accounts for 26%, and 11% comes from other international markets. This breakdown, it really highlights a deliberate strategic implication. The stable, dominant Canadian market serves as the core profit engine, while the U.S. represents the most important, arguably highest potential growth vector for the bank.
Right. This breakdown isn't just about where the money comes from geographically, is it? It speaks to a very deliberate strategy, and it kind of distinguishes RBC from some of its peers, maybe.
Exactly. It highlights a deliberate strategy to be the undisputed leader in Canadian financial services, which, let's face it, it largely is. And then in the U.S., to be a preferred specialized partner, focusing on specific high-value segments, corporate, institutional, high-net-worth clients. Beyond that, it seeks to be a leading financial services partner in select global hubs, focusing on areas where it can leverage existing strengths. So it's a targeted expansion approach, right? Not broad brush growth into every single market, which allows for more focused resource allocation and probably more effective risk management too. 1.4 strategic evolution, HSBC and tech investments.
Okay, targeted expansion. And speaking of strategic shifts, the most significant recent move for RBC has clearly been the HSBC Bank Canada acquisition. This wasn't just another deal, was it? At $13.5 billion, it was the largest acquisition in RBC's entire 155-year history, closed on March 28, 2024. Added, what was it, approximately 780,000 new clients.
Yeah, around that number. And a substantial $75 billion in both loans and deposits added to RBC's balance sheet. Huge numbers.
Massive.
And the strategic rationale behind this acquisition is particularly insightful, I think. Unlike some of its Canadian peers who've pursued large-scale international diversification, maybe in Latin America or other regions, RBC made a very clear decision here. Deep in its domestic moat.
Domestic moat, okay.
Yeah, it wasn't about planting flags in new, maybe unfamiliar territories. Instead, it was about reinforcing its dominant position in a market it knows extremely well, acquiring a valuable portfolio of, specifically, affluent newcomers and commercial clients with international needs. This move enhances scale, synergy potential, all within its core Canadian market, consolidating its leadership.
That's a fascinating distinction. So this wasn't just about getting bigger. It was about getting smarter in its core market. Targeting specific high-value client segments that align with its existing strengths. But here's the critical question then. While it's touted as a smarter play to double down domestically, couldn't this strategy actually expose RBC more to Canadian-specific risks, especially with all the talk about household debt and, you know, a concentrated market? Is this truly smarter or maybe just safer in the short term, potentially missing out on higher growth international markets? What's the trade-off?
That's an excellent point, and it really is the heart of the strategic debate, isn't it? RBC clearly believes it's smarter because it enhances scale and client density in a market they know intimately, where they already have formidable infrastructure, regulatory expertise, the whole package. The risks are known and, they would argue, manageable. This approach also allows them to focus significant resources on digital transformation, which is absolutely critical for staying competitive everywhere. RBC has committed, what, over $5 billion to technology in fiscal 2024 alone.
$5 billion, wow.
Yeah, focusing intensely on leveraging data, AI, sophisticated digital platforms. This investment is aimed at enhancing the client experience, improving operational efficiency, securing future growth. And you know, part of its international strategy, even within this domestic focus, is the launch of RBC Clear in the U.S. That's a next-gen cash management platform for corporate clients, specifically designed to diversify the bank's U.S. funding sources and address a historical challenge they've had there.
Okay, RBC Clear, diversifying U.S. funding. So for you, the listener, this massive investment in tech, it isn't just about flashy new apps. It's crucial, enhancing client experience, operational efficiency. And it's a direct response to evolving market pressures, competitive pressures. They need cutting-edge digital capabilities. It's about building the infrastructure to stay ahead. Regardless of whether they expand aggressively internationally or consolidate domestically, it's really a foundational concept doing business in modern finance, isn't it?
Absolutely. Table stakes now.
Okay, now that we've really dug into RBC's inner workings, its strategic choices, let's zoom out a bit. Let's place it within the, well, unique Canadian financial landscape, explore the industry it operates in, its competitive position, and that formidable regulatory environment we touched on. 2.1, Canadian banking sector, and oligopoly's resilience.
Right. The Canadian banking sector is truly unique. It's often characterized as a mature oligopoly, dominated by what everyone calls the big six banks: RBC, TD, BMO, Scotiabank, CIBC, and National Bank. Collectively, these institutions control well over 90% of the country's banking assets. It's incredibly concentrated.
90% plus, that's dominant.
It is. And this concentrated structure creates exceptionally high barriers to entry for any new players. It gives the incumbents significant pricing power and generally fosters a stable, albeit you could argue less competitive operating environment compared to, say, the U.S.
So it's very much a club, essentially, with high walls keeping others out. But even within that stable environment, there are still significant economic headwinds the sector has to navigate right now, right? We're talking about a period of economic uncertainty, higher debt servicing costs for consumers, businesses, a general weakening of the economy, maybe, and that normalization of credit losses we mentioned coming off those unsustainably low levels during the pandemic.
Indeed. All those factors are in play. However, there is an anticipated shift on the horizon regarding interest rates. The consensus outlook suggests the Bank of Canada will probably begin to lower its policy rate in the latter half of 2024, maybe sooner than the U.S. Fed.
Okay, rate cuts potentially coming.
Yeah, and that's a critical development. It's expected to provide some relief to highly indebted borrowers and potentially stabilize bank net interest margins, or NIMs, which have been under some pressure from intense deposit competition lately. But this whole situation raises an important question, doesn't it? In such a concentrated market, how do the dominant players maintain their position? And what does that actually mean for consumers? In terms of choice, service quality, potential fees, does less competition inevitably mean, you know, less favorable terms for the average Canadian? It's a fair question. 2.2 RBC's competitive edge, leader of the pack.
It's a critical point to consider. And when we talk about dominant players, RBC is truly the leader of the pack among the big six. It's the market leader by most metrics, holding a hashtag one or hashtag two market share position in virtually all key retail and business products in Canada. They're everywhere.
Right. And to give you a concrete example of this dominance, mortgages, RBC currently holds approximately 20% of the Canadian residential mortgage market. Now, following the acquisition of HSBC Canada, that share is projected to increase to about 21.7%.
So grabbing even more share there.
Exactly. And this move further solidifies the Big Six's collective dominance in mortgages. Their share of outstanding mortgages rose largely just because of this single transaction, making it even harder for smaller players, like credit unions or alternative lenders, to gain significant traction.
And it's a similar story for deposits and credit cards, presumably. Even if the exact up-to-the-minute market share data isn't always public, the consolidated nature of the market pretty much guarantees RBC a leading position, right?
That's generally the case. Their vast retail and commercial client base gives them a formidable deposit-gathering franchise, which is crucial for funding their lending activities at a reasonable cost. And they're definitely one of the dominant issuers of credit cards in Canada. So the upshot here for you listening is that RBC isn't just big. It's a deeply entrenched dominant force, particularly in those bread-and-butter financial services that Canadians use every single day. 2.3, the regulatory moat. OSFI's influence.
Deeply entrenched. Okay. And this market structure is heavily influenced by the regulatory moat, as you called it, provided by the Office of the Superintendent of Financial Institutions, OSFI. OSFI is known globally, isn't it, for its conservative, proactive approach to supervising Canadian financial institutions.
Very much so. And in 2023-2024, they introduced several significant regulatory updates. For example, a new supervisory framework. Effective April 1st, 2024. It's designed to be more risk-sensitive, allowing for earlier intervention by OSFI, and provides more granular oversight of the bank's risk profiles.
And they've also dramatically broadened their focus beyond just purely financial risks, haven't they? There's been increased emphasis on non-financial risk guidelines, like Guideline B15 on climate risk management, mandating enhanced disclosures, scenario analysis, and Guideline E21 on operational resilience, requiring banks to build robust defenses against disruptions.
That's right. Climate, operational resilience, major focuses now. And importantly, OSFI's mandate was officially expanded recently to include oversight of institutions' policies to protect against threats to their integrity and security, including things like foreign interference. That's new territory.
Foreign interference, okay. Sure. And on top of all of this, capital requirements remain robust.
Mm-hmm.
The domestic stability buffer, the DSB, maintained at 3.50% of risk-weighted assets for Canada's big banks, the D-SIBs. Ensuring high capital levels.
Right. And what's truly fascinating here, and maybe a point often missed, is how these increasingly complex non-financial risk regulations, while certainly a significant compliance burden, no doubt about it, they actually seem to reinforce the competitive moat of the Big Six.
Reinforce it. How so?
Well, these regulations demand substantial investments in data infrastructure, specialized expertise, sophisticated reporting systems. Large incumbents like RBC, they can absorb these costs as, well, part of doing business. But the burden is disproportionately higher for smaller competitors and for potential new entrants. This dynamic effectively raises the barriers to entry even higher, further strengthening the entrenched market position of the largest banks. It's almost like the government is, perhaps inadvertently, helping the giants get bigger and stronger relative to everyone else.
It's a regulatory environment that paradoxically creates a competitive advantage for the giants, solidifying their position. Now let's talk about fintech disruption. It's a huge global trend. Canada, however, has been a notable laggard among developed nations, both in fintech adoption and in implementing a formal open banking framework. You cited numbers like 13% of Canadian banking consumers using fintech services, compared with, 32% in the UK, 42% in the US. That's a big gap. Why? Why such a stark difference? 2.4 fintech disruption. Canada's unique position?
Yeah, it is a significant gap. There are a few compelling reasons proposed for this. It's partly attributed to consistently high levels of customer satisfaction with the existing Big Six banks, and maybe a general reluctance among Canadians to switch financial providers. There's a lot of trust built over generations. And while the federal government has signaled its intent to introduce open banking legislation, which would theoretically allow consumers to securely share their financial data with third-party providers, fostering more competition and innovation, well, the framework's development has been remarkably slow. Facing various stakeholder inputs, implementation challenges, it's dragging on.
So in this kind of slow burn disruption environment, how are the Big Six, and particularly RBC, responding? Are they just sitting back, complacent, or are they proactively using this extra time they seem to have?
Oh, they're definitely not complacent. Not at all. They're investing heavily in their own digital platforms, AI capabilities, and selectively partnering with fintech firms where it makes strategic sense for them. RBC's significant technology budget, that $5 billion plus in fiscal 2024 we mentioned, and its robust focus on digital client acquisition and experience. These are direct responses to this evolving competitive landscape. They're absolutely using this period of slower disruption to fortify their own digital offerings, to integrate next-generation technologies before true challengers can really gain significant ground.
Okay, so for you, the listener, while disruption is definitely a global trend, Canada's specific market dynamics create this unique environment where incumbents like RBC have, well, more time to adapt. But make no mistake, right? Adaptation is still absolutely critical to stay relevant and competitive in the long run. It's strategic breathing room, perhaps, but not a permission slip to stand still.
Precisely. They know they need to keep moving.
Okay, let's shift gears now into part three, the numbers game financial performance and health. This is where we look at the hard data, focusing on RBC's performance from, say, 2022 up to Q2 2024, and try to understand the story those numbers are telling us. 3.1 revenue and margins. Growth in a shifting rate environment.
Right. RBC's financial performance over this period really showcases a transition, moving from a post-pandemic recovery phase into a more challenging environment, characterized by those rising interest rates and normalizing credit conditions we discussed. But throughout, the bank's diversified business model and its strong capital base have been absolutely key to its resilient performance. Starting with revenue and margins, RBC has shown pretty consistent and strong revenue growth. Total revenue for fiscal year 2023 was substantial, $56.1 billion.
$56 billion. Okay.
And in the second quarter of 2024, pre-provision, pre-tax earnings, they grew a strong 16% year over year, which indicates robust underlying business momentum across the board.
And crucially, that growth wasn't just concentrated in one area, was it? Which again speaks to that diversified model you keep emphasizing. Personal and commercial banking benefited from higher rate spreads, increased loan volume, while capital markets delivered that record revenue on the back of resurgent M&A and origination activity. So it's not just growth, it's balanced growth, it seems.
Exactly. That balance is evident. The bank's consolidated net interest margin, or NIM, has also shown some expansion in this rising rate environment, moving from 1.50% in fiscal 2023 up to 1.54% in Q2 2024. Now, this expansion was notably aided by the acquisition of HSBC Canada, which brought in a substantial deposit base, though, as we'll discuss later, potentially a lower margin one initially. The Canadian banking segment's NAM specifically has shown signs of stabilizing recently. It rose 4 basis points sequentially in Q2 2024. This seems to be a result of the benefits from repricing assets at higher yields starting to offset that intense competition for deposits.
Okay, so while rising rates can be a double-edged sword, good for lending, but also raises funding costs, RBC seems to be navigating it pretty well on the revenue side so far. But what about credit quality? That's the other side of the coin. A key theme since 2023 has definitely been the normalization of credit quality. Coming off those unsustainably low pandemic levels, provisions for credit losses, PCLs, have been on a clear upward trend. What's the story these numbers are telling us about the Canadian consumer right now? Is it worrying? 3.2 credit quality, normalization and resilience.
They certainly have been trending up. Total PCL for fiscal 2023 was $2.47 billion, a significant increase from the prior year, and this trend continued into 2024. Q2 PCL reached $920 million. That's up $320 million year over year. The PCL on loans ratio, that key measure of credit cost relative to the loan book, was 29 basis points for fiscal 2023, and it rose to 41 basis points in Q2 2024.
41 basis points.
Yeah. And management is actually guided for impaired loan provisions to be in the 30 to 35 basis point range for the full 2024 fiscal year. So expecting it to stay somewhat elevated. It's also important to note, though, that the Q2 2024 PCL figure includes a one-time non-recurring initial provision, about $200 million. On the performing loans acquired from HSBC, that's mandated by IFRS 9 accounting standards. So you have to adjust for that a bit.
Right, that IFRS 9 impact. Got it. Those numbers represent a clear trend, though, upward pressure on credit costs. And the Q2 2024 performance here, you mentioned earlier, provides a textbook illustration of the strategic benefit of RBC's diversified business model. Can you expand on that again?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a perfect real-world example of that shock absorber in action. During that quarter, the bank experienced both record-breaking earnings in its capital markets segment and a significant, though anticipated, increase in PCLs within its core lending businesses. The market-sensitive capital markets division thrived in a volatile environment that was conducive to trading deal-making. Net income surged over 30% year over year, as we said. This strong performance provided a substantial earnings buffer. It more than offset the drag from that $320 million year over year increase in PCLs, which are, frankly, a predictable consequence of the credit cycle turning in the personal and commercial banking segment. So the ability of one segment to outperform while another faces cyclical headwinds, it allowed the bank to post overall net income growth of 7% for the quarter. This dynamic truly showcases how the non-correlated nature of its business lines acts as that shock absorber, enabling consistent profitability through varying market conditions, and, you know, underpinning its premium valuation, 3.3 profitability and efficiency, best in class.
That's a powerful demonstration of diversification in action. Really clear. Okay, moving on to profitability and efficiency. RBC consistently maintains a, well, best-in-class profitability profile among its peers, doesn't it? Its return on equity, ROE, a primary measure of how effectively it generates profit from shareholder capital, looks strong, 14.2% in fiscal 2023, 14.5% in Q2 2024, and the adjusted ROE for Q2 2024 was even higher, 15.5%, reflecting underlying operational strength. Okay, so given that high ROE, how much flexibility did RBC really have compared to its peers when it comes to, say, making further strategic investments or navigating unexpected market shocks? Does it give them more wiggle room?
That's a great question. And yes, it absolutely does. A high ROE means RBC is incredibly effective at turning shareholder capital into profit. That's the core reason for its premium valuation in the market. More practically, it generates substantial internal capital. That gives it significant flexibility. It means they can deploy more resources into technology, like they are. They can absorb higher credit losses if the economy worsens more than expected, or pursue value-accretive acquisitions like HSBC without overly straining the balance sheet. This efficiency, this profitability, it's a core component of its competitive advantage. And beyond just profitability, the bank has also demonstrated disciplined expense management. The all-bank efficiency ratio that measures non-interest expense as a percentage of total revenue was 59.9% in fiscal 2023. Which is okay, but management particularly highlighted the Canadian banking segment. That reported a highly efficient ratio of 39% in Q2 2024.
39%, that's very efficient.
Extremely efficient. It indicates strong cost control where it matters most in that core engine. 3.4 capital strength, robust and rebuilding.
Excellent, okay. And finally for this section, let's talk capital strength. RBC maintains a robust capital position, you said, providing a significant buffer against unexpected losses. The Common Equity Tier 1, CET1 ratio, the most critical measure of capital strength, stood at an exceptionally high 14.5% at the end of fiscal 2023. That's really high.
It was very high, yes. Now, as anticipated, the CET1 ratio did decrease following the closing of the HSBC Canada acquisition. It settled at 12.8% at the end of Q2 2024.
Down to 12.8%.
Oh, yeah. So that's a 210 basis point sequential decline, almost entirely due to the acquisition. But, and this is the important part, it's crucial to stress that the bank still comfortably sits above the regulatory minimum requirements. So for you, the listener, what this really means is that even after making its largest acquisition in history, RBC maintains a significant buffer against unexpected losses and is still well positioned for future growth. Furthermore, book value per share, BVPS, showed growth from about $60.76 in 2022 to around $62.34 in 2023. And management noted overall book value growth of 8% in the second quarter of 2024 alone, which signals robust internal capital generation, even with the acquisition impact.
Okay, so summarizing the financial picture then, we see an institution demonstrating consistent revenue growth, normalizing credit quality, but managed effectively by its diversified model, best-in-class profitability, and a robust capital position that allows for big strategic maneuvers like the HSBC acquisition while remaining financially sound. It's a picture of strength and discipline management, wouldn't you say?
I think that's a fair assessment based on these numbers, yes. Strong and disciplined.
Okay, now let's look ahead. Let's dive into part four, challenges and opportunities navigating the future. This is where we examine what's on the horizon for RBC, both the hurdles and the potential pathways for growth. First up, the big one, the HSBC integration. Now, the technical integration of HSBC's systems, the clients, that was apparently executed seamlessly over a single weekend, which is, frankly, a testament to RBC's operational and tech capabilities. That's impressive. But the financial and strategic integration, that seems to present ongoing challenges. 4.1, the HSBC integration.
A marathon, not a sprint.
That's a crucial distinction, yes. The plumbing worked, but the economics are taking time. A key challenge that has already emerged relates to the profitability of the acquired loan and deposit portfolio. Management has publicly stated, and this is a direct quote, basically, that initial lower than expected margins may push out the realization of our previously stated 2-year target by a couple of quarters.
Pushing out the target, okay. Yeah, pushing out the target for achieving the full $1.4 billion in synergized earnings they initially projected. This recalibration suggests that, well, in the period leading up to the sales closing, HSBC Canada likely engaged in some aggressive pricing on mortgages, on deposits, probably to prevent client attrition while the deal was pending.
Trying to keep customers from walking before the deal closed. Yeah. Makes sense.
Exactly. So RBC is now absorbing this lower margin book, meaning that while the long-term strategic benefits scale, client acquisition, they remain. The path to achieving the targeted financial returns will likely be longer than first anticipated. This isn't just a delay, right? It highlights the inherent friction in these large-scale integrations, even for a seasoned player like RBC. And it suggests that even those seemingly smarter domestic plays aren't without their, let's say, hidden costs or aggressive pre-acquisition tactics by the selling party.
Right. So it's not a failure, but it's definitely not as quick a win as maybe initially hoped. And it really underlines that even the most well-planned acquisitions can have bumps in the road. On the positive side, though, you mentioned RBC has already achieved an annualized run rate of $360 million in expense synergies.
That's right, which is approximately half of its total target on the cost side. So good progress there. And they also report that early client retention has actually been above their initial expectations. So you're right. It's a mixed bag right now on the integration front. Costs tracking well, clients are staying, but revenue synergies are taking longer. 4.2 interest rate cycle, a double-edged sword.
Okay, a mixed bag. Got it. Next challenge opportunity.
Oh.
The interest rate cycle. It continues to be a major factor, doesn't it? The rapid tightening by the Bank of Canada between March 2022 and July 2023. That certainly created a challenging operating environment. Higher interest rates increased debt servicing costs for consumers, businesses, leading to that predictable weakening of credit quality across the board.
Absolutely. That tightening phase had a clear impact. However, as we discussed, there's anticipated relief now. Management anticipates a divergence in policy. The Bank of Canada expected to lower rates sooner than the U.S. Federal Reserve. How does that actually play out for RBC, particularly for its interest margins? These anticipated rate cuts, they could provide some relief for borrowers, yes, potentially stimulate loan growth, capital markets activity, but couldn't they also squeeze the bank's own interest margins if deposit competition stays fierce? Or if lending rates fall faster than funding costs?
Yeah, that's the potential downside, isn't it?
It is the double-edged sword. Falling rates would ease credit pressure, which is definitely a positive overall, but they do pose a risk to net interest margins if the rates RBC pays on deposits don't fall as quickly, or if competitive pressures keep lending rates from, you know, holding firm as much as they'd like. It's a delicate balance to manage. But I think the overall economic benefit, reduced debt servicing costs for consumers and businesses, that would likely outweigh a modest margin compression, because that stimulates broader economic activity, which eventually benefits the bank through loan growth, higher transaction volumes, fewer defaults, 4.3 Canadian housing market, the payment shock risk.
Okay, so the net effect of rate cuts is likely positive, even with margin pressure. Makes sense. And closely linked to the interest rate cycle is, of course, the Canadian housing market. This remains a key risk, doesn't it? Given the exceptionally high levels of household indebtedness in Canada, primarily mortgage debt, the primary challenge, which many Canadians are acutely aware of right now, is the looming payment shock faced by homeowners who are renewing their fixed-rate mortgages at significantly higher interest rates than their original terms.
It's a truly critical point. For Canadian households, and by extension, for the banks like RBC. Now management has expressed confidence in the overall quality and resilience of its mortgage portfolio. They cite strong credit scores, low loan-to-value ratios. But they also acknowledge that pockets of stress are becoming evident, as consumers' pandemic-era savings are drawn down and those higher payments bite. For you, the listener, this is a crucial point. The health of the housing market directly impacts not just your potential financial well-being, but the stability of institutions like RBC. So it's vital to monitor indicators like mortgage delinquencies, unemployment rates, household savings rates, things like that. 4.4 ongoing tech investment, a cost of doing business.
Absolutely critical to watch. Yeah. Then there's the ongoing tech investment. We touched on this earlier. It feels like a persistent challenge and essentially a non-negotiable cost of doing business for all the big incumbent banks now. They constantly need to invest in technology to maintain a competitive edge against those fintech disruptors and just to meet evolving customer expectations for digital everything.
That's exactly right. It requires a significant ongoing capital commitment. RBC's tech spending that $5 billion plus in fiscal 2024 is indicative of this pressure. These investments are crucial, developing AI capabilities, enhancing the digital client experience, improving operational efficiency across all segments. However, they also represent a significant component of the bank's non-interest expense growth, creating a clear trade-off, right? Investing heavily for future competitiveness, but potentially at the expense of current profitability or efficiency ratios. It's a strategic necessity, though, not an optional luxury anymore. 4.5 growth engines targeting high-value segments.
Strategic necessity.
Okay.
Despite these challenges, though, RBC is actively pursuing several well-defined growth engines, with a particular focus on expanding its U.S. presence, enhancing its wealth management and capital markets franchises, and leveraging digital tech.
Right. The U.S. market presence is probably the most significant geographic growth opportunity for them. And RBC's strategy here, as we noted, isn't to compete in mass market retail banking. That's not their game in the U.S. It's to focus on specific high-value segments where they feel they have a competitive advantage, namely corporate, institutional, and high-net-worth clients. A cornerstone of the strategy is the recent launch of RBC Clear.
RBC Clear, right, that cash management platform.
Exactly. That cloud-native next-generation cash management platform for corporate clients. This initiative is strategically critical because it addresses that historical challenge Canadian banks have faced in the U.S., the lack of a stable, low-cost U.S. dollar deposit base. By gathering operational deposits from corporate clients, RBC Clear aims to create a diversified, less expensive source of funding. Funding for its U.S. loan growth in capital markets and also at its U.S. private bank, City National. Success here would really de-risk the entire U.S. growth plan by reducing reliance on more volatile, expensive wholesale funding, thereby enhancing margins, building a more resilient foundation for expansion down south. They're also heavily focused on improving the profitability of City National Bank itself, targeting, quote, more normalized profitability as we exit 2025.
Okay, so RBC Clear and fixing City National are key U.S. priorities. Beyond the U.S., global wealth management and capital markets remain key pillars for growth too, right? In wealth management, the focus is on organic growth, attracting top advisors, growing fee-based assets.
That's the plan. Attracting and retaining top-tier financial advisors, steadily growing those fee-based assets. And the Canadian wealth management business actually had a record assets under administration AUA of nearly $620 billion in Q2 2024.
$620 billion. That's a massive pool of assets they're managing or administering.
It's huge. And in capital markets, RBC is successfully gaining market share in advisory and origination work. Investment banking revenue surged an impressive 45% year-over-year in Q2 2024. Strong momentum there. The strategy involves focusing on more profitable, multi-product mandates, improving sector diversification. This segment is really designed to capture those high-value, complex transactions for corporations and institutions globally.
Okay. And finally, digital banking and cross-selling synergy. This feels like a massive opportunity, particularly after swallowing HSBC Canada whole. RBC is leveraging technology to drive client acquisition deep in existing relationships. They welcomed a record number of newcomers to Canada in Q2 2024, you said, up 30% year over year, largely driven by digital offerings.
That's what they reported, yes. Strong growth in attracting newcomers via digital channels. They're also expanding their loyalty program partnerships with major retailers like Metro, Pattison Food Group, trying to create a broader ecosystem, generate more cross-selling opportunities within that ecosystem.
Right. And this is where that massive HSBC acquisition really starts to potentially pay off, isn't it? Creating incredible cross-selling opportunities, benefiting both the bank and the newly acquired customers by offering them the full suite of RBC services, which HSBC maybe didn't have or wasn't pushing as hard.
Precisely. Management has expressed real excitement about this potential, offering RBC's broader product suite things like credit cards, home equity lines of credit, HLOCs, wealth management services to that newly acquired, generally affluent HSBC client base. And furthermore, RBC can now offer HSBC's sophisticated trade finance and international cash management capabilities to its existing Canadian commercial clients who maybe need those services, creating really valuable two-way revenue synergies that leverage the respective strengths of both legacy organizations. That's the hope anyway.
Okay, that cross-selling potential sounds significant. Let's transition now to part five, shareholder value and risk management. These are really two interconnected sides of the same coin when you're looking at a financial institution, aren't they? First, capital allocation. A stable and growing dividend is, well, a cornerstone of the investment case for Canadian banks. And RBC has a long, very consistent history of dividend payments. 5.1 capital allocation, balancing growth and returns.
It certainly does. RBC's dividend policy is guided by its earnings outlook, a target payout ratio, and, of course, the imperative to maintain strong capital levels. Reflecting confidence in its financial outlook, RBC's board approved a 3% increase to the quarterly dividend back on May 30th, 2024, raising it by $0.04 to $1.42 per share.
Okay, another dividend hike.
Yep. This follows a pattern of steady increases. Declared dividends per common share rising from $4.96 in fiscal 2022 to $5.34 in 2023, and now an annualized rate of $5.68 based on that new quarterly amount for 2024. Steady upward climb.
Right. And in addition to dividends, RBC also returns capital to shareholders through share repurchase programs, or buybacks. On May 29, 2024, the bank announced a new normal course issuer bid, NCIB, to purchase up to 30 million of its common shares. This marks a resumption of buybacks, right?
Yeah.
Because they didn't buy back shares for cancellation in fiscal 2022 or 2023, did they?
No, they paused during the run-up and immediate aftermath of the HSBC deal closing. So this new program is primarily intended to offset dilution from its dividend reinvestment plan, or DIP. That's where shareholders can use their cash dividends to automatically buy more shares.
Okay, so mostly offsetting DIP dilution.
Primarily, yes. But the decision to reinstate buybacks so quickly after the largest acquisition in its history, I think that's a powerful signal. It shows management's confidence in its ability to rapidly rebuild capital through robust internal earnings generation. The HSBC transaction caused that significant but planned reduction in the bank's CET1 ratio. So by immediately authorizing both a dividend increase and a substantial buyback, management is essentially communicating its strong belief in the bank's capacity to rapidly rebuild that capital buffer. It serves to reassure investors that the HSBC acquisition hasn't unduly strained the balance sheet, and that the underlying business remains highly profitable and capable of supporting both growth and significant shareholder returns.
That's a good point. It signals confidence. Mm-hmm. Management has also articulated a pretty balanced set of capital allocation priorities, haven't they? First, fund organic growth and strategic investments like tech. Second, support the dividend. And third, pursue value-accretive acquisitions or return excess capital via buybacks.
That's the stated framework. And following the major capital deployment for HSBC, the near-term focus has clearly shifted back to organic growth and shareholder returns, dividends, and buybacks. RBC's dividend payout ratio has been managed within a sustainable range overall. 45% in fiscal 2022, it rose to 52% in 2023, before settling back around 50% projected for 2024. Now, while those recent figures are at the upper end of the typical 40-50% target range for the sector, they likely reflect that period of elevated credit provisions and those one-time acquisition costs. Rather than an unsustainable policy, they're expected to normalize back down within the target range over time. 5.2 risk assessment, navigating the knowns and unknowns.
Okay, payout ratio slightly elevated, but understandable. Moving on to risk assessment. As a systemically important financial institution, RBC is exposed to a wide array of risk. Credit risk is probably the most significant, right?
Typically, yes. And gross impaired loans, GILs, are definitely rising. Increased by 58% year over year as of October 31, 2024, with the GIL ratio rising to 0.59%. This trend is most pronounced in the personal and commercial banking segments, a direct result, as we've said, of higher interest rates and a slowing economy. Now, while this is clearly an area to monitor closely, management has stated they're comfortable with their U.S. commercial real estate exposure, noting that exposure to the particularly challenged U.S. multifamily sector is less than 1% of total loans, which indicates a relatively controlled approach in that specific volatile market segment.
Okay, U.S. CRE seems contained for now, but the primary unquantified risk facing RBC and indeed the entire Canadian banking sector is the potential for a hard landing for the Canadian economy, isn't it? The base case scenario for both management and the market seems to be a soft landing, where anticipated interest rate cuts provide timely relief to those highly indebted consumers. But this is the big what-if scenario, isn't it? The one that keeps financial analysts up at night. What happens if things don't go as smoothly as planned for the Canadian economy? What would that look like for RBC?
Exactly. That's the key macroeconomic risk. The bear case is one where inflation proves unexpectedly persistent, preventing the central bank from cutting rates as much or as soon as hoped. And perhaps unemployment rises sharply. Now, given that Canada has the highest household debt to disposable income ratio in the G7, a scenario of widespread job losses would significantly impair borrowers' ability to service their debts. Mortgages, car loans, credit cards. This would cause credit losses to accelerate well beyond current forecasts, severely impacting the earnings of that core personal and commercial banking segment. And the bank's high revenue concentration in Canada, that 63% figure, would amplify the negative effects of such a domestic downturn, making it the most significant bear case scenario to consider for RBC specifically.
Right. That concentration cuts both ways. Good when Canada's strong, risky if it weakens significantly. There are also market and interest rate risks, obviously. RBC's earnings are highly sensitive to changes in interest rates, as we discussed with NIM. The rising rate environment of 2022-2023 was a net benefit to margins, but stressed borrowers. Conversely, an environment of falling rates, expected to ease pressure on credit quality, but could also lead to margin compression if competition for deposits stays intense. It's that constant balancing act.
It is. And furthermore, regulatory and compliance risks are ever-present. They never go away. RBC operates in a highly regulated industry, faces the risk of sanctions, financial loss, reputational damage from failing to comply with a complex, constantly evolving set of rules. Basel III, AML, consumer protection, the recent expansion of OSFI's mandate into those non-financial risks, climate, operational resilience, cybersecurity adds further layers of complexity and cost. And crucially, the integration of HSBC's large, internationally focused client base. That also introduces a heightened level of anti-money laundering, AML, and compliance risk that must be managed extremely carefully, given the international nature of those clients and transactions.
The HSBC book adds specific compliance risk, too. Interesting. And finally, operational and competitive risks. Cybersecurity remains a paramount threat, right? Requiring continuous substantial investment in defenses to protect customer data, bank systems. That's huge. And in the long term, RBC faces competitive threats from those agile fintech companies. That could disrupt traditional banking services, particularly in areas like payments or maybe wealth management. RBC's primary mitigation for this risk seems to be its substantial and ongoing investment in its own technology and digital platforms, trying to stay ahead of the curve.
That's their main defense, yes. Invest heavily to compete.
Premium, but with watchful eyes.
Okay, let's move to valuation. RBC's stock consistently trades at a premium to its Canadian peers, doesn't it? A dynamic, you said, is supported by its consistently higher ROE and perceived lower risk operating model.
That's the general justification, yes. And an analysis of RBC's valuation multiples reveals a significant expansion over the past couple of years. Its price-to-earnings PE ratio stood at approximately 15.1x based on August 2025 estimates when this analysis was done. Now, that's a notable increase from its fiscal year-end 2023 PE of around 9.6x, and it's definitely above its historical 5- and 10-year averages, which typically fall more in the 12x to 13x range. Similarly, the price-to-book PB ratio was approximately 2.2x as of mid-2025 estimates, compared to an average PB of about 1.47x for 2023 and 1.53x for 2022. So definite multiple expansion has occurred.
Right. So it's clear RBC commands a premium valuation justified by its superior ROE, lower perceived risk. But this premium also introduces a valuation risk, doesn't it? Doesn't that mean the market has priced in a lot of good news already, leaving maybe little room for error? What happens if they don't hit those HSBC synergy targets on the revised timeline, or if the Canadian economy takes an unexpected nosedive?
Exactly. That's the crux of the valuation risk. The market has high expectations for RBC right now. While the premium reflects confidence, it absolutely introduces that valuation risk. The stock is vulnerable if the bank doesn't deliver as expected, or if the macroeconomic environment takes an unfavorable turn. The current multiples suggest that the market is already pricing in a highly positive future outlook, including assumptions of a successful, albeit slightly delayed, integration of HSBC Canada, a soft landing for the Canadian economy, and the benefits of those anticipated interest rate cuts. This leaves little margin for error. Any negative surprises may be higher than expected credit losses,
A failure to deliver on HSBC synergies even on the delayed timeline could trigger a contraction of these multiples back toward historical averages, which would likely lead to underperformance of the stock even if the underlying business remains solid.
Right. High expectations mean higher risk of disappointment. And when we look at dividend yield, as a function of its higher valuation, RBC's dividend yield is typically lower than its peers, isn't it? As of mid-2025 estimates, the yield was around 3.5%, compared to yields maybe above 5% for TD and Scotiabank at the time.
That's generally the case, yes. For yield-focused investors, some peers might appear more attractive purely on a current income basis. But the lower yield on RBC's stock is essentially the trade-off. The trade-off for what the market perceives as its higher growth prospects and lower overall risk profile, which are reflected in its premium stock price and valuation multiples. You pay more, you get less current yield, hoping for better growth or stability. 5.4, management and governance. Steering the ship.
Okay, valuation trade-offs understood. Finally, let's briefly consider management quality and corporate governance. Critical for a large, complex bank, RBC seems to benefit from an experienced and stable leadership team.
It does. David McKay, the president and CEO, has served since 2014, so over a decade of consistent leadership now. He's a long-tenured RBC executive himself, joined the bank way back in 1988. His tenure has been characterized by a strong focus on technological innovation and obviously the execution of that landmark HSBC Canada acquisition. This stability and deep institutional knowledge represent a significant competitive advantage, I think, especially when navigating complex integrations or market shifts. Catherine Gibson, as CFO, responsible for financial stewardship. The segment leaders are all seasoned executives with deep expertise. And the management team overall has a strong track record of execution, delivering consistent profitability, successfully navigating various economic cycles, with the seamless technical integration of HSBC Canada being a recent, very prominent example of their operational capability.
Right. So strong leadership, governance, critical, especially for navigating complex financial waters and these huge acquisitions. RBC's corporate governance structure also seems to adhere to best practices. Independent board chair.
Yes. They have an independent, non-executive board chair, Jacinthe Côté, which ensures a separation of power from the CEO and fosters independent oversight. That's considered best practice. The board itself is composed of highly qualified individuals with diverse professional backgrounds, finance, risk, tech, etc., and it maintains four key standing committees: audit, governance, human resources, and risk, all composed of and chaired by independent directors, ensuring robust oversight in key areas. Checks and balances seem strong.
Okay, good governance structure in place. And that brings us to part six, investment thesis bull versus bear and what to watch. Let's try to summarize the key arguments that frame an investment decision for RBC. Weighing the optimistic, the bull case, against the pessimistic, the bear case. 6.1, the bull case, why RBC continues to shine.
Okay, for the bull case, RBC's dominant market position and scale are primary arguments. Its leadership in that stable, profitable Canadian banking oligopoly provides a durable competitive advantage, further reinforced now by the HSBC acquisition, which creates significant opportunities for scale-based efficiencies and those revenue synergies we discussed. Secondly, its diversified and resilient earnings power. That well-balanced mix of businesses, stable retail banking, high-growth wealth management, opportunistic capital markets provides a resilient earnings stream, one that can perform reasonably well through various stages of the economic cycle. That shock absorber effect.
Right. Add to that its superior profitability and capital generation. RBC consistently generates higher ROE than its peers, demonstrating superior operational efficiency, profitability. This allows for strong internal capital generation, which funds both strategic growth initiatives and consistent growing returns to shareholders through dividends and buybacks. And finally, there seem to be clear strategic growth pathways, particularly in the U.S. market with the launch of RBC Clear, the continued build-out of wealth management, capital markets franchises, carefully targeting those high-value segments. 6.2, the bear case. The road ahead is not without bumps.
Okay, that's the bull case. Now, for the bear case, we need to consider several counterpoints. Its macroeconomic sensitivity and concentration risk are key. We keep coming back to this. With 63% of its revenue derived from Canada, RBC's performance is heavily tied to the health of the domestic economy. A hard landing scenario, higher for longer rates, rising unemployment would significantly stress the highly indebted Canadian consumer and could lead to credit losses that exceed current expectations by a wide margin. Secondly, those credit normalization headwinds are clear and present. Provisions for credit losses are on a clear upward trend, expected to continue rising through 2024 at least. This normalization from unsustainably low levels will act as a direct headwind to near-term earnings growth. No escaping that.
Right. Headwinds are real. There's also the HSBC integration and synergy risk we detailed. While the technical integration was a success, achieving the full financial benefits presents a challenge. Management has already signaled that potential delay in realizing the earnings synergy target due to lower margins. Any failure to meet synergy goals, even on the revised timeline, or retain key clients, that could make the deal less accretive than originally modeled, potentially eating into shareholder value. And finally, as we just discussed, RBC's elevated valuation. The stock is currently trading at PE and PB multiples above historical averages, suggesting a positive outlook is already reflected in the price, leaving the stock vulnerable to a derating if the bank fails to execute or if the macro environment deteriorates more than anticipated. 6.3 critical factors to monitor, your investor checklist.
Okay, so bulls and bears laid out. What should you, as an investor or just an interested observer, be watching closely? This provides a kind of roadmap for critical thinking. These aren't just numbers. They're vital signs for assessing RBC's ongoing health and trajectory. First, you'll definitely want to track quarterly asset quality metrics, specifically provisions for credit losses, PCLs, the PCL on loans ratio, and gross impaired loan GIL formations. These will be primary indicators of how the credit cycle is impacting the bank's loan book and the financial health of the Canadian consumer.
Makes sense. Keep a very close eye on credit. You should also watch HSBC integration progress. Specifically, listen to management commentary on synergy realization, both cost and revenue sides. Watch client retention rates from the acquired portfolio and track the trajectory of net interest margins, specifically on the HSBC loan and deposit books. Are they improving? Also, the overall net interest margin trajectory, especially in Canadian banking. Observe the net impact of Bank of Canada interest rate decisions versus those ongoing competitive pricing pressures for loans and deposits.
Absolutely. NII evolution is key. Further, monitor U.S. platform growth. Get progress reports on RBC Clear's ability to gather those low-cost U.S. dollar deposits and watch the path to improve profitability at City National Bank. Is it happening? This is a critical de-risking strategy for them. And finally, keep an eye on capital ratios. Ensure the CET1 ratio comfortably rebuilds above regulatory requirements and starts to rebuild organically through retained earnings following that big hit from the HSBC acquisition. #CheckCheckUtterall.
Okay. And that wraps up our deep dive into the Royal Bank of Canada. We've peeled back quite a few layers, haven't we, on everything from its deeply diversified business segments to the bold strategic moves in the U.S. and the ongoing nuances of that massive HSBC acquisition. It's clear that while RBC stands as a formidable financial institution, a true financial fortress, maybe, it's also navigating a complex and ever-changing landscape. Economic cycles, demanding regulatory oversight, rapid technological evolution. It's a lot.
It is a lot. And this deep dive, I think, has shown us that RBC's resilience is really rooted in its diversified model and its strong capital base. That provides significant buffers. However, its premium valuation also means it faces those high expectations from the market. Understanding the interplay of its core Canadian dominance, its targeted U.S. growth strategy, and the absolutely crucial role of its ongoing tech investments, that's really key to appreciating its current position and its future trajectory.
Definitely. So as you think about all this, here's a final thought for you to maybe mull over. Consider how RBC's strategy of deepening its domestic moat through the HSBC acquisition, rather than pursuing large-scale international expansion like some of its peers, how might that play out differently over the next decade? Does this make RBC more secure against global shocks, or maybe potentially more exposed to a single market's challenges if Canada faces a uniquely difficult economic period down the road? It's a fascinating trade-off to ponder, isn't it? And one that highlights the distinct path this particular financial giant is forging. Keep these insights in mind.